Accession number 30018, reel 14.
John Farley, reel 14. This business of the Royal Air Force wanting a new aeroplane, whether it's a jump jet or an ordinary one, they're going to issue some sort of operational requirement, which is their wish list for how this thing will perform, how fast it'll go, how much it'll carry, how far it'll go and so on. And you're going to get that operational requirement. Normally speaking, the staff that write operational requirements, if they've got any sense, they go and talk to manufacturers about what is likely to be the possible improvement in the next generation. So they're not totally pulled out of a blue sky, you know. These numbers have got some relationship to reality. The OR people may stick an extra 5% on to try and, you know, push the manufacturers a bit. But in general, they're going to come up with requirements like that. We, or Hawkers, suggested that this aircraft would have operating site flexibility. You could fly it from all sorts of sites that you couldn't fly ordinary airplanes from, like, for example, grass. And so they would immediately bounce back and say, well, in that case, what happens if it goes unserviceable there? We need to replace the engine. And so that's how that particular spec point came in, from the common sense operator's point of view. And I wasn't privy to that conversation, but I imagine they probably said to the company, how long do you reckon, you know, it would take? And I don't know, half a day? All right, well, we'll give you 4 hours and see if you can do that, you know. That's pure conjecture on my part, but something like that must have gone on. Going to the ordinary flying, military flying machine stuff, I mentioned that the aircraft had to pull 6G, which is a measure of how quickly it can turn. Pull 6G at 10,000 feet, 400 knot speed, 16,800 pounds. This was to make sure, so far as the Royal Air Force was concerned, that they had the sort of manoeuvrability that they needed out of their jet fighters. They didn't want to give something up because it was a jump jet. When Hawkers first flew the prototype Harrier, not the P1127 now, not the Kestrel which came next, but the Harrier, the first one, XV-276, and that was flown in August 66. I didn't join the company until September the following year, by which time they had three or four of these Harrier prototypes, or they were called DB, development batch Harriers, flying, and they were starting to look at a variety of spec points, as you would, and one they found they couldn't meet was this 6G. They were getting 5G, and I was involved in a lot of the flights to try and get 6G out of the airplane. Now, what are you going to do? The weight is fixed, the speed is fixed, the height is fixed. You just can't get any more G because the wing stalls. All right, well, we're going to have to improve the wing. All right, let's try a little bit of flap, what's called combat flap. If you put a lot of flap down, you're going to get drag and you'll never get the speed. But you can put a little bit of flap down and increase the lift of a wing without doing very much for its drag. Not the sort of angles you see on landing, but small angles, 10, 15 degrees. And so we had a combat flap setting, mid-flap as it was called, which produced 5.5G without any disadvantage. Now we're left with half a G. If we put the nozzles down, that easily produced the extra G that we wanted. But the pilots thought that's not really what the Air Force wanted. The Air Force hadn't intended that we use the nozzles to get extra G in ordinary combat. And it's cheating sort of thing. And if you do put the nozzles down, then you're going to start losing speed thereafter and so on. So although it could literally have demonstrated the spec point, the Hawker pilot said, no, 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 we want the wing developed to get the extra half G. And we did a lot of flying on that. Now, in order to develop a wing, to get that extra bit of G, you put what is called dressing on a wing. You put a variety of sort of fixes, which are all external to the structure of the wing. If you look round any highly developed aeroplane, you'll see little vortex generators, you'll see funny little kinks in the leading edge, you'll see lumps and bumps all over it. And these are devices which are aimed at fine-tuning the airflow around that wing just before it stalls, so that you get more maximum lift coefficient out of the thing. These dressings for this wing were tested in the wind tunnel models in the conventional way. I don't know how many aerodynamicists at Kingston came up with, but I know there must have been more than 26, because we were getting into greater than letters. We had letters and number combinations that were tried in the tunnel. We only flew, I don't know, five or six of these combinations, the most promising ones, and eventually we found one that would give us the extra half a G, and that went into service on the wing, on the RAF aeroplane. And that's another example of the sort of very non-glamorous sort of basic development work that is required to improve an aeroplane. Day after day you would go off and try and pull 6G, you know, in some different configuration of aerodynamics on the thing, and come back and they get the recorder that, oh, you've done 5.8, all right, well, we're going to change that vortex generator, and overnight they prise them off the wing and put a different fit on, go and try that sort of thing. So yes, I was involved with that sort of thing from the word go.
So in a sense, is it almost, I mean, trial and error is probably too wrong a word, because obviously there's much more thought and development go into it, but is there an element of that where they're trying different things all the time just to improve the performance for that specification?
Oh, very much so. I mean, trial and error is a perfectly reasonable description. It is not as simple as, anybody got any ideas? Or try that. I mean, there's a very good basis for the idea, but in going from model scale or theoretical calculation through to practical full-sized aeroplane, there are some variations on the predictions. Sometimes the thing will be a little bit better than you hope for full scale, and sometimes it won't be as good, and you've therefore got to go around the boy again and do another iteration. This was so, for example, when we were doing the Hawk many years later, we had some buffet at the back end at high speed, and it was a case of trying to develop a fairing at the base of the fin which got rid of the buffet, and it was known as Fred's back end, because Fred Sutton was the chief flight test engineer, and as a result of looking at tufts, these are bits of wool like material which are held onto the airframe in the airflow using sticky tape, and if you cover the aeroplane with these wool tufts, or in this case cover the fin and rudder with these wool tufts and the rear fuselage, you can see where the tufts stream steadily from an aeroplane alongside with a camera, or where they are waving about, and the shape of the aeroplane is obviously not too good, or the airflow wouldn't be being disturbed. And if the tufts are thrashing about, then you've probably got something wrong upwind of the tufts. And we use tufts to modify this fairing, Fred's back end. So yeah, that's trial and error. And once you've got looking at stuff with tufts, then that's very much trial and error. And but you can still use skill and experience in interpreting the way the tufts are wobbling about, and you say, I reckon that's because of so-and-so.
And when you joined the project, you mentioned obviously the state at which the project was at. What had been the specification from the RAF for the Harrier? What did they want it for? What type of aircraft?
Oh, close air support, what's known in the trade as mud moving. In other words, it was only intended to attack targets on the ground. It was not intended to be an air defence aeroplane, but purely a short-range aircraft just behind the front line, which was there with this operating site flexibility that could support the army as they were struggling against whatever in Central Europe. That was the concept. And although it was originally on paper based from, well, you go from farmers' fields and the like, in reality, once they got the Harriers out in Germany, although they practiced from fields, and they went out with their tents and camped, and they practiced from holes in woods and things, and wooded clearings and the like, the war plan was all about using roads and car parks. And indeed, the practical difficulties of supplying a hole in the wood with fuel and weapons and how many lorries and what when they get bogged down and very weather dependent. I mean, whilst it is literally possible to hide your aeroplane from visual observation in a wood or something, you don't actually hide it from infrared very well. On the other hand, if you go into the nearby small town, commandeer the supermarket, clear out the car park, now you can have your Harrier standing on the hard. You've got your pilots that, of course, have got to be looked after because they're sissies, sleeping, you know, inside the supermarket, not in a tent. And everybody's happy, and you can pull the bowser up to the aeroplane because it's not going to get bogged down. And by the way, it's all in a town, and so there's infrared hotspots all over the place, and so it's not so easy to spot the thing. So the reality was that more practical sites, roads and car parks and so on, were specified for how they would be used in combat.
And at this stage, was the thoughts to selling the Harrier to other countries?
I don't know at what stage Hawkers thought they'd be able to sell this thing. I honestly don't know. I suspect that they didn't think about it at all. We're talking 64, 65, 66 time. They didn't think about it then because they were all... It was all about, can we sell it to the Royal Air Force? Can we get our own service to buy it? Because my impression of Hawkers was that they were very realistic people and they never thought you were likely to sell an aeroplane overseas if you couldn't sell it to your own nation first. What's wrong with the thing, you know? At the time, now we're getting to 66 and 67 when I was joining them, we certainly weren't thinking about selling it anywhere else. We were thinking about, can we get it to meet the spec? Can we get it into service in 1969 as we have promised? On April the 1st, yesterday, all those years ago. So I don't think there was much thought about selling it. Certainly the marketing department was one man, John Crampton, and he was called the technical sales manager, and he was involved as much with talking to the RAF and the MOD as they were then, or just becoming, as he was anybody else. But then, in the Farnborough Air Show of 1968, up popped these two Marines, Bud Baker and Tom Miller. Tom Miller was a full colonel, Bud Baker was a lieutenant colonel. These were staff officers in the Pentagon. They were very experienced aviators, but they were on a ground job in the Pentagon. They visited Farnborough. They watched the Harrier fly at Farnborough, development batch aeroplane doing its demonstration, and they said they wanted to have a go at it because they thought the Marine Corps needed that sort of aeroplane. Now, I'm quite sure that it wasn't an on the spur-of-the-moment type thought at Farnborough. I'm quite sure they came over to Farnborough knowing all about it and thinking, we'll watch it and then we'll go along and approach Hawker Siddeley because we want to fly that. Bill Bedford, by now, he had joined the marketing department as the sales manager, and the technical sales manager, John Crampton, was his sort of number two. He was approached by, because they didn't know what to do with Bill after he stopped flying, so he was approached by these two Marines, we want to fly your aeroplane. Well, Bill, knowing the state of the aeroplane, it wasn't ready for the Royal Air Force, let alone for Americans, and knowing that we had no two-seater, knowing that we had no simulator, he went straight to me and said, what do you think, you know, can we, well, it's not really on, is it, you know? And I said, well, I think we can do it, but we'll have to get the ministry to give us approval because they own the aeroplanes. We weren't our own lords and masters in that regard. And so there was a lot of devilling went on with the ministry before it was agreed that these two United States Marine Corps pilots could fly one of the development batch aeroplanes at Dunsfold.
Before we actually go on to that, was there any kind of corresponding program in the United States at the time for a vertical takeoff aircraft at all?
There were lots of corresponding programs in the United States. I mean, if you look at the history of non-helicopter VSTOL, because that's what we're talking about. And by helicopter, I mean a simple, straightforward thing with a rotor on the top, a rotor at the back, or two rotors on the top, with nothing other than simple rotors. There were compound helicopters, which were trying to go faster from a vertical takeoff. They had stub wings, they had other engines on the stub wings that could pull them along and so on. There were tail-sitting prop jet fighters that were supposed to come to the hover and lower themselves onto their tail and take off vertically. There were jet aeroplanes, tail-sitters. There was a vectored thrust research aeroplane in the United States operated by NASA. There were a total, or to date, there are a total of 45 different programs that actually intended to fly. They were all tested to some extent or another. Some were only tested tethered, others were tested considerably and with several of them built. But the French did a whole lot of vertical takeoff jet fighters based on the Mirage series. Anyhow, the point is that of these 45, only three aeroplanes have got to the point where, or three programs got to the point where they were sufficiently practical and proven to go into service. Ours was the Harrier. Then the Russian Navy got the Yak-38. And now, literally, as we speak at the beginning of 2007, the United States are just about to get the Osprey into service. So there were all sorts of programs going on, and they were all unsuccessful, which is why the Marines were looking at this thing, which clearly had got apparent signs of success. I mean, it was being demonstrated at air shows, for goodness sake, etc., etc.
So the clearance came from the ministry for the...
Yes, it did, and I got the job of checking these two guys out. They said to me, we want to fly it twice. You tell us what to do on the first flight and we'll tell you what we're going to do on the second flight. So I knew that wasn't going to work, and I knew that we had got to go through some sort of conversion process, which, because of my philosophy of I only want people to do one new thing per flight, was probably going to involve a dozen or 15 flights in the aeroplane, maybe only a minute or two long, but, you know, going to get in and out of it. So it certainly wasn't going to be one flight. We'll tell you what we're going to do. This was a Thursday afternoon, and they said, we're going back Tuesday. And so, I mean, I was asked by Bill to come over and talk to these guys and bring what I'd got of the pilot's notes, because I'd been asked to write the pilot's notes. They didn't exist at that stage, and what had I got so far, sort of thing. And I made the point that they would have to stay for 2 or 3 weeks, and we'd be looking at quite a long programme, and we'd got to convert them first, etc., etc. I imagine, although I wasn't privy to that, I imagine they went and made phone calls back to base, you know, and I imagine they probably thought it was going to be done that way anyhow, but I don't know. But eventually it was all agreed, and a week or so later they came to Dunsfold and I started their conversion process. And it was... my philosophy was one thing at a time, and I wanted to frighten them with the sheer power of this engine. Frighten's the wrong word. I wanted to impress them with the power of this engine in safe circumstances where if they made a mistake, it wasn't going to cause a problem. So I... Because it's very difficult when you've got a tiny little Mickey Mouse thing, as this aircraft seemed to people who are used to flying Phantoms. It's very difficult to get people in the right frame of mind before getting into this apparent toy. So I set them up with a 1.3 to 1 thrust weight ratio. In other words, they had very little fuel in the aeroplane. And that meant it was going to accelerate as a conventional aircraft with a thrust of 1.3 times G. Well, with a thrust of weight ratio 1.3, you can accelerate at 1.3 G. And to put it in context, something from a standing start accelerating at 1.3 G will get to the legal limit on our motorways in 2.4 seconds. So, you know, that's lurching off. So I wanted them to get into the aeroplane, not with the point of view of going to fly it, but just thinking about how to start it up, how to taxi it, get used to the nose of steering, the brakes and so on, and then to do what I called an axial stop, where they set off down the runway as if for a conventional takeoff. But they were briefed when they got to 50 knots, only 50 knots, to close the throttle, put the brakes on, stop, turn around and come back. Well, good guys normally got the throttle off at about 70 because the thing just lurched off so quickly. They were surprised. The average guy used to get to about 90. Poor old Bud Baker, who had taken offence at the thought that anybody had to teach him how to taxi an aeroplane, he got to 120 knots before... You know, he got the throttle off because he was so surprised at the way this thing accelerated. I mean, it snapped your head back, wallop, on the headrest and so on. So now the problem is to stop it. Well, they were briefed to stop it just by putting the brakes on. How else, you might say? Well, how else with ordinary aeroplanes was that you also pulled the stick back, because that presses the tail down and helps the wheels and brakes grip the ground, or helps the tyres grip the ground, not the brakes, the tyres. And we see that sort of downforce put on Formula One motor cars to help their grip and so on. Well, when Bud had this thing run away with him, I mean, there's nothing dangerous about it. He's only gone 200 or 300 yards down the runway, but he's got this ridiculous speed on already. The psychologists say that when somebody is caught on the hop, as it were, like that, they revert to their most current type. And he reverted to what you do to stop a Phantom. Well, you put the toe brakes on, exactly the same as in a Harrier, but you also pull the stick back to improve the braking efficiency. So he pulled the stick back. Nothing wrong with that, except he's right-handed, and when he pulled it back, he moved it over towards the right. That didn't matter in a Phantom when you're on the ground with its wide undercarriage and so on, and big heavy thing. It wasn't going to roll. But this Harrier got to 120 knots. It would have flown at 150 on the wings alone. So when he pulled the stick back and also moved it to the right, the nose wheel left the ground and the aeroplane rotated about its right-hand outrigger and the nose came up and the aeroplane rolled right. I mean, that's what we're talking about. And he caught the right-hand tailplane tip on the runway and dragged that along the runway, and there's a shower of sparks and it's grinding off the tailplane tip before the thing gives a big shake and falls back down on its wheels again, you see. So, of course, he came in and he had eyes like organ stops, of course. Then, doesn't it go? I said, right, now you understand that any time you get into this aeroplane again, before you open the throttle or you move the nozzle lever, before you take either of those controls and move them over their whole range, you engage your brain first and think about what is going to happen next, because there isn't time to think about it after it started happening. And so that was the point of the taxi session, to set people up so that they did not underestimate the effect of moving the throttle and nozzle lever in this, with this huge engine, ever. And it was to do it in circumstances that were safe and straightforward, and it worked. And Bud, thereafter, I mean, I got him, you know, I'd got him, and he just soaked up every other briefing after that like a sponge, and he did a brilliant evaluation of the aeroplane, and so did Tom, his boss, and they went back and they wrote this glowing report about the capability of the aeroplane. So we didn't sell it to the Americans. The Americans came and bought it from us, and there's quite a difference.
In a sense, though, there, we, when we talked about earlier about the idea of when you first went into the aircraft, you did a step-by-step, how am I going to think through this? Was it a case when he tried it that it was almost overconfidence that he, because he'd handled a lot of types and the format?
Well, that was what I had to stamp out of him with many other pilots after that, with this taxi session, and if you set them up properly with, you know, a couple hundred pounds of fuel aside and so on, you could get their attention. And having done that, you then set about doing the actual business of flying. And you said, all right, fine, now I want you to go out now and do this vertical takeoff. As soon as it leaves the ground, come back down again and do a vertical landing. Oh, well, I hadn't thought of doing it. I was thinking of flying it conventionally first, because, you know. Well, maybe, but take my word for it, there's nothing you would learn by flying it conventionally which will be the least bit of use to you in flying it vertically, and you've got to fly it vertically, so that's what we're going to do next. And by the way, it's 3:30 in the afternoon, and if you get off conventionally, they're going to shut Boscombe early tonight anyhow, because they're doing night flying, so we haven't got a diversion, and so we've got the rest of the afternoon. It's too early to start. We're going to do your vertical flying. Right, so fine, go and do it. Okay, you happy? You're going to go and do it? Well, are you going to give us a brief? Yeah, of course I'll give you a brief. So they sit down, they've got these pilot suits on with bits of plastic on their kneeboards and things, and he licks his chinograph pencil, because you say there are four things you're going to do on this trip that you haven't done on your taxi session. Just four things. So they're starting to write down 1, 2, 3. No, don't write anything down. Just listen to me. If you can't remember four things, you didn't ought to be getting in this aeroplane, all right? So, right, four things. The first thing is, I mean, four things that you didn't do on the taxi session, remember? If there's anything you want to repeat on the taxi session, that's fine. No, you're happy? Okay. So you're going to taxi out at the beginning of the runway, and the first thing you're going to do is you're going to ask air traffic for permission to take off. Ha ha, everybody knows you have to ask air traffic. So there's only three things. Right, next thing you're going to do, which you didn't do on your taxi session, is get hold of that nozzle lever and point it straight down at the ground. The third thing you're going to do is place the throttle fully forward, and up it will go. Well, wait a minute, you said there were four things. Talk to air traffic, ha ha, pull the nozzle lever back, yes, open the throttle, what's the fourth thing? Look out of the window! I want you looking out of the window when you open that throttle, because when it leaves the ground, you have got something else to do, and that is you've got to keep the aeroplane flat. If you let the aeroplane tilt in any direction, that will tilt the thrust and the aeroplane will start wandering off. You let the right wing go down a bit, it'll go off to the right, and the hangar's only 400 yards away over there, right? So we want to keep you where you are. Now, you know, if you're going to keep it flat, you have to know what the view looks like with it flat. And the view is exactly what you've got on the ground. It's not going to change. It's flat. So hoist in that view and then open the throttle. And just hang on to that view. This will be the easiest takeoff you have ever done in any aeroplane, because with any other aircraft, you run on the ground to some speed you've not been to before, you have to pull a stick back and a mount you're not sure of till the nose comes up, and then you're not quite sure whether that's the right angle or not, and it leaves the ground, and then you've got to adjust it for the climbing angle. You know, there's none of that. You've just got to keep this view.